Well, hello everybody. This is Troy coming to you from New York City and truthloveenergy.com. And while I'm trying to fight a very bad cold and very bad cough, instead of channeling, I thought that I would share with you something of a more personal nature. And I apologize if I cough or sneeze or sniffle during my little story. But I promise you that just by listening over your headphones or through your computer, you will not catch what I have, and I will not get anything on you. I promise. Well, I thought since it's difficult for me to channel while in this state, I thought I could go ahead and continue getting some audio casts up online by sharing with you how I met Michael. So I'm going to share it with you briefly, but, you know, enough for you to get a sense of my history with Michael and how that came about. So, let's see. I think it was in approximately 1987 that I was starting to take more seriously my experiences I was having with non-physical presences. I've always had a sense of connection with whatever might be called the other side. But my nature isn't to, you know, so quickly go, ooh, that's, real. So it didn't matter that I was seeing colors around people, and it didn't matter that I would see what I guess were spirits or other, whatever they were. I would just sort of take it in stride and make a note of it. And actually it was a long time before I realized that not everybody saw those things. So it's not something that I talk to too many people about, even though I do this work publicly. In my personal life, a lot of people are actually kind of surprised that I have this whole other fantastical metaphysical side, because I just don't use it as my persona. I don't use it as my first way of introducing myself to people. Mostly because most people who are into this kind of work are kind of loony, and most people who are drawn to it are kind of loony. So I distance myself from that, I guess probably because of, who knows, arrogance. Chief negative feature of arrogance. Maybe there's a judgmental aspect to this. But I'd like to think that it's just a more practical aspect. Who knows? But so I started taking it seriously in the late 80s that there was a way to harness what I was experiencing. And just to make a long story short, I started focusing on what I guess you could call automatic writing. So I started keeping journals where I had made contact with an energy or a presence that I decided to call guide. And I called him guide because I don't like those billowy, new agey, purple, glittery, metaphysical names for energies. So I just sort of called him guide. But I did get creative and call it G-Y-D-E. So, you know, there was a little bit of a creative element there. So I started keeping contact with guide, and I kept a journal, and I kept that pretty much to myself. But I would ask questions about life, and I did my own personal tests that would help me to see that there was something legitimate going on, but not quite sure what it was. I still had the concept of, you know, this guide might be a part of my own consciousness or a part of my own broader perspective that I just didn't have conscious access to. So, and I was fine with that. As long as there was something legitimately phenomenal going on, then I would just keep exploring. So after about a year and a half of collecting automatic writing from guide, I started sharing it a little bit more with some of my closer friends. And that would lead to conversations about, well, I wonder what we were in past lives, or I wonder if we could figure out if we were connected before, or how to make some sort of practical use of this supposed contact that I was having with my guide. So I took on a few experiments with a few people, and some of the first things that happened were one of my friends asked if asked about a love relationship she was in. And as I was getting the information in my journal from guide, guide was telling me about their past associations in Guam, and talked about a land dispute and how this particular land dispute caused a rift between the girl and the boy in that past life, and that they never were able to reconcile their or to come together their relationship because of some, them being on opposing sides to this supposed land dispute. So, and they gave the years, and they gave some more details and some advice about or suggestions about how they could, how that past life may be influencing their current relationship and what to do about it and so on. So I basically edited out all of the stuff that had details and just sort of conveyed to my friend the essence of the information, which was the more immediately applicable information, you know, just insights into what they could do to make life better for each other and so on. So I, but I kept mulling over in my head all these details that had come out of the channeling, such as dates and names of places and so on. And basically, guide said to me at one point, one of these days you're going to have to prove to yourself that this is real. And this is the best way to go about it, to have some tangible evidence. So why don't you go look up this information and see if it's true? Now, that might not seem that big of a impression that could be made, but having very little knowledge of geography and history, this would be pretty impressive to me if I got that kind of stuff through me. So I put it off for a long time trying to have that validated. I kept putting it off and putting it off, and I was actually making myself sick with it, because one part of me was very excited about the possibilities of it being true, and the other part of me was scared to death that it wasn't. And if that wasn't true, then that would mean that all of my exploration were basically just my being crazy and a little loony, you know. And I'm already a little loony, so that's, that would have been fine, but you know what I mean. So one day while I was at work, I decided that I needed to do it, and I wasn't even really thinking about it consciously. I was just sort of, it had been on my mind so much, and I was feeling very ill and sick, and so my friend let me use her car to leave work early. And as I was driving, I didn't even realize it, but, oh, I have to back up, because guide also, not only did he suggest that I have it validated, but he said, here's a title of a book for you to look up the information so that you can have this proven, that it, that it's legitimate information coming through. So I had the title of this book in my mind, and that's why I started mulling things over, because now I just had all this stuff that I could check out, and I was avoiding it. So that day when I was leaving work and driving, I found myself turning into the parking lot of a library. And when I pulled up to the library, you know, I was all sweaty and scared, and I got out of the car and I went into the library, and I was basically on autopilot. And I went to the little card catalog thing, and I looked, and there it was, the title of the book. I went to the bookshelf where it was, and I pulled the book off the shelf, and I was already freaking out that there was an actual book with that title in front of me and in my hands. But I still had hope that it was just, you know, a fluke. So I started looking through the book, and it was a book about Guam and its history. And what I ended up finding out was that there was a land dispute in the frame of time that was given. I can't remember what it is now, because I'm just telling you this story back off the top of my head. That was a long time ago. But but I looked, when I was looking, it told me that that was during the time that the United States was taking over Guam, or taking it on as a, I don't know how it works, but they were basically buying up Guam. And it fit within the year, time frame that the that guide had given me. And but the most, and even then I was still skeptical and still fighting the possibility of it being valid. So the last bit of information was the city that these two were supposedly from. And I looked on the map and there was no city by that name. I think it was Sienta Pier or something like that, Sienta Pier. And when I saw that there was no city by that name, I simultaneously felt shocked and relieved, because there was some part of me that thought, thank God, this isn't real. I don't have to do anything about this anymore, and I don't have to follow up on it. And who cares if I'm crazy? I can just go back to being like a normal person. And then I realized that there was a map in the back of the book. And as I looked at the map on the back of the book, there along the coast was the city Sienta Pier. And the reason why it wasn't on any of the other maps was because that those maps were showing Guam's changing landscape and cities after the U.S. Took it over. Previous to that, Sienta Pier existed. So I made myself even sicker thinking about the possibilities of actually having contact. It was kind of fun to have the contact, you know, as a part of my life, but to have it being legitimized and validated for me, there was something just disturbing about it, and I was very resistant to it. And I was even resistant to the concept of reincarnation, believe it or not. I thought that was the dumbest idea ever. Now it totally makes sense to me, but back then, mm-mm. So after that, I went and had my nice conversation with Guide, and Guide said that he would be leaving soon, because I, now that I had that experience, I would be opening up to a larger source of information. And I kind of took that in stride as well, because I was still sort of reeling from the validation that I had experienced. And so over the next, I guess it was about the next week or so, I just took it for granted Guide would always be there. Excuse me. And I was asking questions like normal, and I was really fascinated by this point that here was this, not, this wasn't just an imaginary friend. This was some, or this was either an individual consciousness, or it was a part of my consciousness that was bigger than I could have ever imagined. So I was asking all kinds of questions. And I was going back through all of my notes over the past year and a half or two with Guide and reading them. And I had decided that I would try to sit, or Guide, when Guide told me that he was leaving, I wanted to actually experience Guide in a way that I'd never experienced before. So my friend and I, who ended up being my essence twin, sat down with the Ouija board and decided to ask Guide to come through the board. So I sat down and we started asking questions through the board, and I find the Ouija board to be extremely tedious. It's not fun. I think it's extremely boring. Although it's mystical and fun in that sense, it's just kind of boring and tedious to try to sit there. And I think a lot of people don't know how to use it properly, and they think that the planchette's actually moving independent from them, but it's not. But otherwise, you'd be able to take your fingers off of it. So we sat down and we were asking questions of Guide, or who is there, and all those silly questions that you do at a Ouija board. And Guide, I could sense Guide coming through, but not necessarily in the way that I expected. And alongside that was another energy I didn't recognize. And Michelle was her name, my essence twin. She asked a question that ended up getting a response that said something that wasn't particularly helpful. And I said to her, well, I guess you should just have faith. You know, have faith. And I can't remember what the question was, but I remember saying those words. And then we put our hands back on the planchette, and we were just waiting, and the message came out saying, there is no need for her to have faith. Faith is a lie. Faith is blind acceptance in things you don't know to be true. And I was like, ooh, we've got something dangerous coming through here, because any kind of questioning of the concept of faith just sounded so evil back then. And I said, well, we got to stop, because, you know, who knows what we're doing here. And we put that away. But I was so struck by that concept, like faith is a lie. That particular phrase was very upsetting. And I thought, you know, ooh, we attracted something dark, scary. But the next day, I was at an old bookstore, and I decided to look for some books, like normal. And I was trying to reach for a specific book, and my sleeve or something hooked on another book, and it pulled it off the shelf. And when it pulled it off the shelf, I was flailing all around trying to catch it. And when it landed in my hand, my palm kind of karate chopped into it, and it opened up. And I thought, ooh, this looks weird, because it had a Ouija board on the cover and everything. I thought it looked really cheesy. And I looked at the page that I had split it open to, thinking, oh, there must be a message. You know how you pay attention to those things after a while when you're of old soul and metaphysical nature. And there it was, a quote from Michael saying, faith is a lie. Why I can't remember the quote, but it's faith is a lie. Why should someone not question the truth or find out the truth? Oh, I should have had that quote ready, but those of you who know who Michael or know Michael's teachings know that quote. So I was in shock, because there it was in print, almost the same message I'd received the night before. And I know that it's kind of anticlimactic, because I don't have the quote right here, but it's around here somewhere. But I took that book, I bought that book, I took it home, and as I started reading it, I started getting all kinds of chills, because in my journals for the past 2 years, in my work with Guide, there was all kinds of channeling that had referred to priests and kings and warriors and scholars and old souls and young souls and levels. And this whole time I had been doing it, I was trying to translate it literally. I had figured that priests and kings, all that stuff was literal. And I thought people, you know, that had past lives as those, I thought they were actual jobs that they had or positions in society. And the old and young soul, I didn't quite understand what that meant, because, as I said, I was still sort of resistant to the concept of reincarnation. And then the levels and the numbers, I thought they were based on numerology, so I had been trying to translate everything numerologically and making sense of the numbers that way. This whole time, I had been getting Michael terminology and Michael channeling before I even met Michael. So I was thinking to myself while I was reading this book and comparing them to my notes over the years, I was thinking, oh my God, could this be the larger source of information that God was speaking about? And I devoured the first Michael book, of course, and I went looking for others, and I think I found one more. I think I found the Michael game or something like that, where it had like a conglomeration of channels contributing to the book. And I was shocked that there was this whole organization based on it, the Michael Educational Foundation. So I contacted them. And at that time, it was being run by Aaron Christian, J.P. Van Hul, and Holly Coleman. And I was sending all kinds of photos to them. I have to back up. I talked to Holly, set up a session with her, and I didn't, she didn't have any information about me. And at the time, I was pretty poor, so I had scheduled a session with her, but it was over the phone, and I didn't have a phone at the time. So I had sent her pictures of me for the session, because she needed those, and it was time for my session, and I didn't have a landline, I didn't have a phone, and cell phones weren't around back then like they are today. And so I had my very first contact with Michael through Holly Coleman over a payphone. outside of a mall. So that was my first experience with Michael. And Holly is channeling Michael, and she has a delightful, wonderful way of bringing Michael through. And she, as she was getting information, or as Michael was speaking through here, her, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, oh my God, do you know me? Do you know who I am, Michael? But I did not want to lead the channel in any way to tell me that, oh yes, you have agreements to, well, I mean, I didn't even have that phraseology back then. But I didn't want the channel to tell me what I wanted to hear. So I kept everything to myself. And Michael, through her, at one point said, I said, will I publish any books this lifetime? Excuse me. Sorry about that, good Lord. I had a big coughing fit. So I had asked, will I publish any books this lifetime? And that's when Michael said, well, of course you will. You have agreements with us to write several books based on your work with us, and we've just been waiting for you to remember and fulfill the agreement that we had made. And I was standing there. I wish there was like a reality TV show filming me at the time, because I'm sure my eyes were all bugged out and all shocked and overwhelmed and everything at the time. And I remember another funny part of that session was that in reading the descriptions of the roles and stuff in the books, I had pegged myself as a priest because, you know, I had, you know, such high visions of life and how it should be and what I was going to do in this life. So, you know, and I always want to help everybody. And so I had myself pegged as a priest. And I'll never forget when Michael came through Holly and said, well, we see that you know yourself very well. And you probably already know that you're a sage. And I was like, you could actually hear on the recording myself, my voice going, oh, because I had no concept of my being a sage. Now I don't even understand why I would ever think otherwise. But there, that goes to show you that at the beginning of your understanding of the Michael teachings, you will interpret things pretty superficially until you really grasp the meaning of the terms. So that's when I first had validation that I would be working with Michael. And I took it very seriously, despite my skepticism, despite my resistance. I took it very seriously, and I started practicing. And Holly Coleman was so amazing in keeping an open line of communication with me to help me through it. She became my hotline, because as I started to take on the experiences of working with Michael, it was a huge difference in energy compared to when I first started working with Guide. Guide was like having a friend sitting next to me. Michael was like standing in a room full of people trying to squeeze them into a teeny little body of mine, which is not so teeny, but you know what I'm saying. So I would sit with this, or Holly suggested I sit with the energy, not try to channel it. And that was one of the best suggestions that really got me through. And because when I originally started trying to bring Michael through, I would actually start going into a panic mode, and I would start shaking, and my heart would beat so hard that I actually had someone put their hand on my chest to feel how hard it was beating, and it was scaring them, because I was just having this reaction of panic. And not fear, just this panic. I don't know how to describe it, but I would just go into this strange physical reaction. And we came to find out that supposedly, in a past life, I had also had an inclination toward the metaphysical and the other side. And during those lives, or during that life, it was in the medieval period, supposedly, I had no discrimination whatsoever, and I would just let all kinds of crazy things pop in and out of my body. And basically, everybody around me thought I was crazy, and I was actually killed to put me out of my misery. And apparently, my instinctive center carried that over, you know, time as an unresolved issue. And in this life, once I started channeling, my body would access the instinctive center memories, and basically my body had decided that channeling equals death. So it would go into extreme reaction to try to protect me from bringing anything odd in. And so I had to actually retrain myself and relax and teach myself to that it was safe to do so. But it was pretty funny when I found that out. So after I became comfortable with Michael, then I started taking on practice with friends and stuff, sitting with Michael. And I think some of the most, the reason why I stayed working with Michael is because, as I told you before at the beginning of my story, which did not end up being a short story, I, despite my inclination towards all of this, I have a very discomfort with it. I don't like just accepting it because it's, you know, metaphysical and magical and otherworldly. I feel like I have to have something tangible, something practical, something that's able to be proven. And I know I'm not going to get that 100%, and I understand how this works. But to have some of the time is helpful. So when I first started channeling Michael, and especially when I went public with it, it was very important for me to have the experiences of validating that Michael was present and not just my crazy, you know, imagination. So I'll never forget one of my first clients in the probably the first year. I can't remember who she was now, but I went into my trance like normal, but something different happened this time. When I went into the trance, instead of feeling like I was asleep in another room with the door ajar, hearing people talk, that's the way I always like to describe it. Instead of that, I felt like I had been displaced onto the floor next to my body, and there was a fire burning in a fireplace, and there was a big giant St. Bernard sleeping nearby, and I was very just disoriented, but it felt so comfortable and cozy. And I don't understand what that was about, even to this day, really. But I just took it as my mental interpretation of what was needed to comfort me at the time. And the woman who sat down for her session sat down, and Michael said to her through me, "Did you try the stones we suggested the last time we spoke to you?" And I was very, very upset by this, because it was at that point I realized this woman had had a session with another Michael channel, but she hadn't said anything to me about it. And that was the first time it dawned on me, like, ooh, people could be tricking you and setting you up and you know, channel shopping and stuff. But I just stayed in my trance, relaxed, petting this dog, and just listened in. And she said, "Oh yes, I did, and they seem to have some sort of effect. You know, I seem to, you know, I can't remember what it was, but she seemed to have been helped by the suggestion Michael had." But the weird thing was Michael just picking up where they had supposedly left off with her in another session through another channel. Even more exciting for me was that they picked up their conversation from there and went on. She didn't seem to be fazed by it at all. But the interesting thing was that she got her profile from me, and this was exciting for me. But the next time she came to a group session, she had another profile with her. And she presented to me that the person that she had had her session with before, she didn't realize that that channel had also provided a profile for her. And because it was sent through the mail, it had been delayed and she just got it. But compared to the one she got in my session, there was only one part of the entire profile that didn't match the original profile channel by the other channel. So that was very exciting for me, because I felt very validated in my work with Michael, as well as feeling that Michael exists as an independent consciousness. And over the years, things like that have continued to happen to make me feel comfortable, to keep me going, and just amazes me every day the kind of information that we get from Michael and how we can apply it. And what amazes me even more than all of this story I've been telling you is that the whole entire basis of this Michael teachings and philosophy does not in any way promote dependency, and it doesn't take away your ability to question it. It encourages so much skepticism and so much personal responsibility. And it just makes me really happy that the people who that I seem to attract to me also participate in that. I know there are other Michael channels who seem to attract people who are more inclined towards getting the fluffy stuff and the things that make them feel better, and that's probably really perfect for them. But for me, I can't do that. And that's just because of my nature, I guess. And so I thought I would tell you that story of how I started working with Michael and why I continue to work with Michael, because you should know who you're dealing with. And I hope that was a riveting story and fun to listen to me cough and speak from through the bowels of my illness. And I hope that I get better soon. And I hope that you enjoyed this. And I'll have many more stories to tell you in the future. So enjoy and have a lovely day. Bye-bye.